pleasure to introduce Richard Reyes Babylon. If he could, yes, there he is. Richard Reyes Gavilan will talk to us about democracy's potential, the public library. He is the library system director of the District of Columbia. He's an innovator and he's an urbanist. And I would just say personally, I live in Washington, D.C., and I love what you've done to our libraries to make them really a whole new kind of institution. So I'm delighted that you are going to speak with us. Richard Reyes Gavilan was appointed the executive director of the DC Public Library in 2014 after having worked for almost 20 years at both the New York and the Brooklyn Public Libraries. He was lured to Washington, DC primarily to oversee the $211 million modernization of the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Library, which recently opened. It will be an inspirational destination for innovation, civic empowerment, and delight. Director Reyes Gavilan is also aggressively building and renovating neighborhood libraries all over the city. Two new libraries in the West End and Cleveland Park neighborhoods were awarded the American Institute of Architects DC Chapter Design and Urban Catalyst Awards, respectively. Mr. Reyes Gavilan was recently recognized by the State University of New York at Albany with the 2019 Excellence in Public Service Award. Director Reyes Gavilan, welcome.
Thank you, Richard. Can you hear me okay?
I can very well, yes. Oh, and look at the beautiful library behind you.
Yeah, well, I'm actually, between you and me, I'm in my home right now, but this is our new reading room at the MLK Library. And I should say I'm very impressed with your collection behind you. So very, very appropriate for our conversation this afternoon. A couple of things, and I saw that that Tom jumped off the call, but no harm in a shameless plug. He was mentioning Dr. Hannah Jones, whose 1619 project is being released in book form, and we are hosting Dr. Hannah Jones at the MLK Library on November 18th, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, we're almost already sold out 500 seat space. So people are very eager to hear her, and we are so happy that she is our neighbor at Howard University. But anyway, and Richard, I got the memo late that this was really supposed to just be me talking. I did put together a pretty decent slide deck. I think that ultimately this is really about the built environment and democracy. So I really did want to add some pictures to make this a little bit more fun and great, terrific. So thanks. So let me begin my remarks by expressing my thanks to Richard Margulies for inviting me to speak today. About 2.5 years ago, I spoke at a symposium at the Cosmos Club here in Washington, D.C. The symposium was called Democracy in America, and my presentation was focused on the new role that public libraries around the country are playing as agents of civic engagement and citizen empowerment. I spoke at length specifically about a library in downtown Washington, D.C. that at the time was under renovation, the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Library. And I highlighted all the new programs and services that the building would be able to accommodate in service of a more just, equitable, and democratic city. Richard was in the audience that Saturday and called me a few months later, asking if I would be willing to revisit that talk for a conference that he was in the early stages of organizing called Visioning a Better America. So while I think we're all disappointed that we're not doing this in person, especially because we know that democracy can't truly be achieved virtually, we are ultimately satisfied that the conference is taking place at all. So thanks again, Richard. I know that this has been a real Herculean effort and more work than you could ever have imagined, but I am so glad to be participating. So it is very interesting to revisit that talk I gave at the Cosmos Club in early 2019 for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is that the library that was still under construction during my talk has now been open for about a year. Certainly open with significant restrictions due to the pandemic, but open nonetheless. And getting it open and finishing construction during a pandemic is a whole nother conversation. It's always a thrill for me to talk about public libraries as agents of civic empowerment, especially because many of the audiences that I speak to are not regular users of public libraries, except perhaps for the sporadic attendance at a major author program, or for the use of public library ebooks, and use of our electronic collections continues to surge really across the country. What many people have not noticed, but more and more are taking notice, is that the evolution of the American public library itself over the past quarter century is pretty remarkable. They have evolved from these strictly transactional institutions focused on getting books in the hands of readers and getting the reader out the door, to transformational institutions focused on meeting the social, educational, vocational, and civic needs of residents. I often center this talk around the 21st century library architecture because new public library architecture and building programs are really central to facilitating the transformational uses about which I will be talking a little bit about today. I'll begin sharing my screen now, if that's okay.
Sure. Absolutely.
Great. Do you all have that?
Yes.
Democracy's potential? Terrific. So this graphic tells the story pretty succinctly. Credit to the creative team at Mekanu Architects in the Netherlands for it. Mekanu is the firm that we hired in Washington, D.C. to lead the design work on the MLK Library, and they included this illustration in their submission to show their understanding of the changing role of libraries. Now, you may not agree with everything on this graphic, but I think it you get the picture of where we're going from this very sort of one-dimensional institution, which is beautiful in its own way, but to something a bit more complicated, a bit more active, and frankly, maybe a bit more democratic. One thing that that I like to point out in this graphic from about 6 or 7 years ago is that this little playground slide on the right-hand side of your screen, I remember when I first saw this and I said, okay, I get the meeting rooms and the coffee and the computers, but the kids slide, maybe that's going a bit too far. But as it so happens, when we opened up the library last year, we do in fact have a playground slide in the library going down from the children's room down to the main floor. And it is fast and kids love it. And what better way to get kids reading and learning than giving them some playful experiences as well. Let me back up and share a quotation from the Center for an Urban Future. This is a New York City-based think tank that has been writing about public libraries for almost a decade. It published a report in 2013, my last year in New York, called Branches of Opportunity, that states a distressingly large segment of the city's population lacks these basic building blocks, its basic literacy, language, and technology skills. But the public library has stepped in, becoming the second chance human capital institution. No other institution, public or private, does a better job of reaching people who have been left behind in today's economy, have failed to reach their potential in the city's public school system, or who simply need help navigating an increasingly complex world. And if you are saying, well, this report is from 8 years ago, clearly the technological skills divide is not as significant in 2021 as it was in 2013, you are certainly wrong. Despite the ubiquity of smartphone adoption and the precipitous rise of low-cost laptops and tablets, the challenges of reliable internet access and access to training and skills are still very, very real. Here are a few numbers from the District of Columbia, recent numbers. And just you'll see we're a city of 700,000 people, and you'll see that more than 10%, 76,000 DC adults under the age of 65 lack basic digital literacy skills. I mean, these are really high numbers when you really begin to boil down and study them. Almost two-thirds of employed workers in the District of Columbia who don't have digital skills are from Black and brown populations. And then finally, we see that there are a whole host of new roles that need to be filled in education construction by 2030 that will benefit from some kind of digital literacy training, skills development. And that is really a role that the library has leaned into over the past decade and more, and something that we are really thinking about hard, how to do better. So I'll go back to the Center for an Urban Future report momentarily. And, you know, maybe I'll pose this sort of rhetorical question. How did it happen that libraries could quietly step in and take such a leading role in digital literacy, lifelong learning, vocational training, those sorts of things? This level of optimism and inspiration about the role of the public library in an increasingly digital world did not seem realistic 20, 25 years ago when I started in libraries, especially with the seemingly rapid adoption of affordable high-speed home internet and a major breakthrough in commercial ebook penetration. So in 2000, the horror author Stephen King published a novella called Riding the Bullet. This is the world's first mass market ebook. Hundreds of thousands of copies were sold on the very first day at a really affordable price of $2.50 per book. My colleagues and I at the New York Public Library at the time were standing around that day, expressing awe over what was happening, but internally thinking that, you know, we're all going to be out of work pretty soon. I remember having the sinking feeling that I wasn't sure what future public libraries would have in a world where the ways in which information was being disseminated and access was being disrupted so incredibly profoundly. But a funny thing did happen on the way to certain obsolescence, and in many ways we have bold architecture, good city planning, and possibly fear to thank. And in the interest of time, I'll highlight only maybe one building in particular, and this is Rem Koolhaas's 2004 Seattle Public Central Library. And I, you know, this is my opinion. This building was a game changer for public libraries. It truly revolutionized the notion of what a public library might look like in the digital age. The central gathering space in this jarring, asymmetric glass and steel building was not called the reading room, but it was called the living room, and indicating a really marked shift in how the Seattle Public Library and ultimately many other libraries would define their mission. This was really a dramatic reimagining of a central library. And it was a reimagining not without risk. In libraries, I like to say that nostalgia is currency. If you deviate from the perfect notion of a dark, quiet space fortified by endless rows of 7-foot high bookshelves, do so at your peril. Public libraries everywhere in the early 2000s, in response to changing community needs, really began to diversify their building programs and service offerings and began moving away from being, once again, these transactional institutions designed primarily to facilitate the borrowing of books, to transformational institutions designed to help residents change their lives, learn new skills, especially digital skills, interact meaningfully with their neighbors, access social services, collaborate with peers, and otherwise participate in civic life. We have many examples of this transformation in Washington, D.C. In 2010, as Richard noted in his opening remarks, we began an incredibly aggressive reimagination of the public library system in D.C., fully modernizing or rebuilding 20 dull, dark, and one-dimensional neighborhood libraries with bright, exciting destinations for community learning and participation. I'll show you a couple of examples of those here. So this is our Anacostia Library from the late 1960s in the great Ward 8 of Washington, D.C. This was pretty much what every branch library looked like in D.C. up until about 10 years ago. Some small windows and bricks, pretty much a square, nondescript structure. In 2010, we replaced the Anacostia Library with this phenomenal glass structure. And the most important part of the building, despite it being very striking and welcoming, is really when you look into the interior of these library spaces, you've got better sight lines, better circulation of spaces, you've got lower shelves, and you've got many, many more private spaces for people to meet in groups or alone, study spaces, affinity group meeting spaces. So we really decided to create a program around people's sort of living needs as opposed to just people's borrowing needs. And this is sort of a footprint that a blueprint, I should say, that we've used across the District of Columbia. We're so proud of our building that former President Barack Obama came to visit in 2015. And my understanding is that this is the only public library that the president visited in two terms in office. So we were very happy to welcome him at the Anacostia Library back in 2015. It was a great, great morning and afternoon. Maybe one more example. This is another library in the district, the Francis Gregory Library in Ward 7, similar to the old Anacostia Library and so many others. Again, small windows, pretty dark, pretty blah, one-dimensional, get your books, get on out. This was also rebuilt by David Ajay, and many of you know David Ajay, who designed the National Museum of African American Culture and History. This was actually his first project in DC prior to the museum. This beautiful building, striking, also glass and steel, and similarly on the inside, lots and lots of spaces for people to congregate. If you look up the stairs, you see these meeting rooms and study rooms jutting out over the building entrance, low shelves to promote good sight lines and openness, and is something that are making these buildings so popular, more popular than they were prior to their being renovated for sure. Let me move on to our newest library, and this is the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Library, certainly our most ambitious library project to date. The 400,000 square foot building recently reopened after a 6-year, $211 million modernization, and will certainly redefine the role a central library can play for its city. So despite the 20th century icons most closely associated with the building, that's Martin Luther King Jr. And the original architect, Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, the MLK Library, which first opened in 1972, was never a loved building. It was always an important building symbolically because it was the first major memorial named for Dr. King shortly after his assassination. You can imagine in the late 1960s in Washington, D.C., a city that was at the time 70% Black, with its residents surrounded by monuments and memorials to our founders, all of whom were white and many of whom enslaved Black people. So it was incredibly significant to have the new Central Library named after a Black person, let alone a Black civil rights leader, a controversial person, certainly at the time. It also happened, moving to the architecture piece of the building, it was Mies van der Rohe's only building in Washington, D.C., his only library in the world. It was one of his final libraries. He died, actually, during design, and I always wonder how he would have felt about the finished product. Frankly, to say that the building itself was unloved is probably putting it mildly. Countless residents have spoken to me over the past 7 years about how much they hated visiting that building for a host of reasons related to lack of inspiration, lack of wayfinding, overall darkness and dreariness, and even real concerns with personal safety. Here's a photograph that I took of the public stairwell at the old MLK Library. Sometime before we closed for renovation. It's a pretty accurate representation of the overall interior aesthetic. In fact, the flash of my phone probably is being kind to this stairwell. It wasn't as bright as this picture actually seems to indicate. And fast forward to today, and here is a photograph of the new stairwell at the library with 5-foot diameter skylights that allow natural light to pour down 6 stories of beautifully detailed, organically shaped trapezoidal staircases. Thanks to the commitment of our elected leaders, to our current Mayor Bowser and a number of her predecessors, we largely gutted each floor of the historic building and created an intentional destination of lifelong learning and civic empowerment in the district, one committed to equal access to information and services, but also deeply committed to the concept of equity and fairness. We continue to develop a program of services for the new building focused on serving residents with everything from a new cafe that will provide its employees the opportunity to participate in enhanced workforce development programming to a reimagined local history department concentrating solely on issues of racial and social justice. As I'm sure you all know, DC, we have no voting representation in Congress, and that injustice is something that is very real and tangible for district residents, especially Native Washingtonians. So at the library, we continue to focus our collections and programs on giving residents a voice, despite our inability to vote. And these panels that I'm showing you now are from our new exhibition that opened up in the building that we call Up from the People. And this is our latest acquisition. These were panels that were put up during the George Floyd protests last summer. We were able to get these panels that were created very quickly and were placed on the U.S. Chamber of Commerce building downtown. And we were able to get a hold of these panels, and now they are in our collection at the D.C. Public Library. But it's not just about art and it's not just about architecture. It's really about the individuals that work in libraries that create the real value for our residents. And I wanted to talk a little bit about how that too has changed in DC. So early in 2019, the DC Public Library hired its first coordinator of civic engagement. Among the many jobs that did not exist in the old library, this one probably best illustrates how libraries are changing to better address the pressing social and civic needs of residents rather than simply addressing their reading needs. In addition to coordinating the library's work with the Board of Elections vis-a-vis serving as a voter registration and polling site, the civic engagement coordinator is responsible for identifying partner agencies to populate an entire floor of the modernized MLK library that will be devoted entirely to community alliances. So imagine coming to the MLK library and in addition to getting a good book and participating in an inspiring cultural program, you can also register to vote. You can visit the Department of Health to pick up a COVID-19 at-home test. You might be able to renew your driver's license with the Department of Motor Vehicles. You might get expert assistance on filing your taxes from the AARP, access job placement services with the Department of Employment Services, and sign up for low-cost internet access through the Office of the Chief Technology Officer, all on the same day, all in the same building. And of course, in order to facilitate all these interactions, we had to make some real space commitments in the new building. And that's what we did very early on in the design process. So, before we did much in the way of designing, we were pretty clear that we wanted a big chunk of that building to be devoted to sort of community civic needs. And the whole center, basically, of that building between the first floor and fifth floor is just that. So we sort of put some of the more traditional library services on either wing of the building, but put a lot of the assembly and the community work in the center. And I know that will pay dividends, especially when we are populating that building with a lot of programming, which we currently are not because of just the increasing complexities of the pandemic. But it's a really important decision to be made in order that your building can facilitate the type of sort of civic uses that we had envisioned for it back several years ago. Now, in addition to hiring a civic engagement coordinator, in the past several years, DC Public Library has also hired a certified social worker who herself now employs what we call peer navigators. These are individuals with a lived experience of homelessness who engage directly with library visitors who may need direct intervention and connection to resources such as healthcare, housing, legal assistance, training and the like. The year before the pandemic, we actually added yet another position at the library, and we called that position the credible messenger. And these are young people with a history of involvement in the justice system who are trained to engage at-risk or disconnected youth with resources to help them hopefully find a better or more productive path. In 2015, we opened our first library in the DC jail. And while we're satisfied with the use of the collections that we purchased for the jail, we're more impressed with the life-changing programs we've introduced there. Everything from author talks to workshops, and even our signature summer challenge reading competition. All this is to say that across our city and across cities everywhere in the United States, public libraries have shifted their attention from people's reading needs to people's learning needs to people's existence needs. What can we do to help create and maintain and engage an active and maybe even a delighted citizenry? I'll pause here on this slide and offer that awareness of people's reading needs and providing access to a responsive collection of books and cultivating a love of reading are all ingrained in every good library's DNA and something that we will always prioritize. I don't talk about it as much as I should, the collections and the books, but of course, it is incredibly, incredibly important. We all know that reading, especially reading longer works of fiction and nonfiction, is central to fostering democracy. Some of you, I'm sure, are aware of the Survey of Public Participation in the Arts. This is a survey conducted every few years by the National Endowment of the Arts. Analysis of these surveys have shown strong corollaries, even when you account for different education and income levels, between reading and other forms of civic life that include volunteerism, voting, and even attendance at music and sporting events. With that important caveat in mind, I wanted to highlight other ways that libraries are on the front lines of promoting democracy, especially among our most vulnerable residents, who are often most disconnected from civic life. In the past 5 years alone, in an effort to increase participation with the library, we've added evening and weekend and holiday hours when we know a lot of people might only have access to the library during those off hours. We've eliminated all fines and fees related to overdue items, understanding the barriers that fines and fees pose to low-income residents. We've partnered with DC Public Schools to create automatic barrier-free library accounts. We've even eliminated all the costs associated with using our printers and copiers, understanding how many people use the library as a sort of a business center for vital documents. We're delivering free books to keep to every single home in the District of Columbia to children under the age of 5. And we've expanded our digital literacy offerings to include classes on how residents might be better digital citizens, because we know that in this age of misinformation or disinformation, digital literacy involves much more than learning Microsoft Word or how to write a resume. But most dramatically and most visibly, we are promoting democracy through our impressive campus of fully modernized or rebuilt libraries in the district. This is our new Southwest Library that opened a few months ago near the waterfront here in Ward 6. These inspiring destinations of community learning are as popular as ever, despite the fact that the library's ebooks and other online services have made it easy for some of our readers to enjoy the library without ever setting foot in one. So we're serving people in more ways than ever, and we're not showing any signs of slowing down. You may ask, what about the pandemic? What behavioral changes has the pandemic wrought on public libraries? I think it's really still too soon to tell, so I'll table that question for maybe the next conference, Richard. But I will begin wrapping up here. In 2018, American sociologist Eric Kleinenberg published a fascinating book that I highly recommend. It's called Palaces for the People: How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. Kleinenberg defines social infrastructure as the physical conditions that determine whether social capital develops. In other words, those institutions that have the ability to foster community and connectedness. He opens the book by describing some research he'd undertaken for another book he'd written about the 1995 heat wave in Chicago that killed hundreds of elderly residents, primarily in underserved parts of the city. What he discovered when comparing neighborhoods that were similar with respect to crime, poverty, and other social indicators was that the death toll was significantly higher in neighborhoods lacking places like libraries and parks than in those neighborhoods that had these types of amenities. The point that Kleinenberg makes over and over is that institutions such as libraries really do serve as catalysts of civic engagement, and in some cases can even be a matter of life or death. And as our elected leaders continue to grapple with a major $1 trillion infrastructure initiative that includes much more than roads and bridges, but also includes some of what is now termed social infrastructure, I'll leave you with the quotation on the screen. In a world where we spend ever more of our time staring at screens, blocking out even our most intimate and proximate human contacts, public institutions with open door policies compel us to pay close attention to people nearby. After all, places like libraries are saturated with strangers, people whose bodies are different, whose styles are different, who make different sounds, who speak different languages, give off different, sometimes noxious smells. Spending time in public social infrastructures requires learning to deal with these differences in a civil manner. So I will stop there, maybe 2 minutes under time, Richard. And thanks again for the invite. It was really a pleasure to share that with you all.
Well, wonderful. Thank you, Director Richard.